In this episode of From Bench to Fireside, Pisces Chief Scientific Officer John Connolly chats with Dr. Nina Bardwaj, physician scientist in hematology, medical oncology, and urology at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. The quest to harness our immune cells to combat cancer has captivated scientists for decades. At the forefront of this mission is Dr. Bardwaj, a researcher dedicated to unlocking the full potential of the human immune system with dendritic cell biology. Get ready to go from bench to fireside with Dr. Bardwaj as she shares her mission to conquer cancer with the power of the immune system.
I'm John Connolly, and I'm here with Dr. Nina Bardwaj. Nina is the Ward Coleman Chair of Cancer Research, Professor of Medicine, Hematology, and Oncology at Icahn, and just such an important member of the Pisces community. As an immunologist, she's made seminal contributions to dendritic cell biology, a true expert in human immunology across a number of different immunotherapies. And I think some of those key discoveries that I going through the years of working in this field have been really in the field of understanding the quality of dendritic cell responses in terms of T cells, making that fundamental link between the innate immune system and the adaptive immune system and how dendritic cells play that role. And now is taking that forward into the clinic and really making an impact for patients in terms of the development of vaccines. So this is really a simplification of your career, but you really have excelled at translating basic discoveries into clinically relevant treatments for patients. How did you develop that? What got you into that? And how did you kick this off?
So I actually started my career as a rheumatologist, but always very interested in the underpinnings of how the immune system can be modulated to either attack one's own cells or can be usurped to attack things like cancer. And so starting with that and a foundation in dendritic cell biology, when I did my postdoc with Ralph Steinman at the Rockefeller University, I then progressively moved to looking at how dendritic cells might be targeted to modify responses to viral antigens. So I then moved to influenza and HIV. And at that time, I also developed a relationship with Lloyd Auld at the Cancer Research Institute, who has been a champion, clearly, of how the immune system can be targeted to beat cancer. And his field also was one of cancer vaccines. He was very interested in trying to develop cancer vaccines to treat cancer. And so working with him, the Cancer Research Institute, Stein was also very interested in how we can modulate the immune system in that respect. I shifted gears yet again in my career and went to study cancer immunology with Dr. Auld, Dr. Steinman, and then eventually with Stephen Birakoff.
Yeah, that's just a wonderful lab that you're working in with just incredible people, and Ralph being such an amazing mentor too. It's fortunate to be in such an incredible environment, no doubt about it. And the link up with Lloyd, again, such a champion of cancer immunotherapy, it goes without saying, that's just an amazing foundation that you have. So when you were there, I think one of the things is really this focus on dendritic cell biology early on. I know that obviously Ralph, a Nobel laureate, of course, for the discovery of dendritic cells, but also I think that movement, even at that time toward cancer immunotherapy away from infectious disease, was a bold move early on. There are certainly a group of people doing dendritic cell vaccines back then, but with Ralph and I think Jock and others that were really pushing that forward. But I think that at the time, really that HIV work, some of the other looked very promising. And so what was it really kind of convinced you that this was going to happen? And certainly you were at the cusp of something great right before the explosion of therapy for cancer.
We learned from working with influenza and HIV, the concept that foreign antigens can be targeted by the immune system effectively. And so the concept came up that can we find cancer-associated antigens that could function in a similar manner? Can we usurp either novel antigens expressed by cancer or antigens that are overexpressed by cancer, incorporate into similar kinds of platforms that we could use to generate cancer vaccines? And in our case, we decided to do a very basic experiment, actually, but one that involved humans, and that is to determine inducing immunity to foreign antigens. And so we started by asking whether monocyte-derived DCs taken from healthy donors and pulsed with antigens KLH or tetanus toxoid or things like that. And also foreign antigens like influenza could actually induce an immune response. And then we compared that with non-pulse dendritic cells, and we tested those two formulations in healthy volunteers. And we were able to show in healthy people that only when you give the antigens on dendritic cells could you induce an immune response in these patients. And you could do it safely and lasted several months. And so that was really the first in vivo sort of a proof of concept showing that soluble antigen doesn't work. You need to deliver it in an effective way, dendritic cells being one of them. And at the same time, we'd also developed this method to generate monocyte-derived DCs from monocytes in blood, again, working with Ralph and Jacques, and were able to show that these GMIL4 primed monocytes matured with, at that time was a monocyte conditioned medium as a cocktail, could be quite effective. And then we also went on to show that you need mature dendritic cells. If you give immature dendritic cells to people, you actually end up getting the wrong immune response. So we learned a lot from those very early basic experiments showing that they could be equally effective in inducing immune response. And that's how we started.
That next leap, I think, into trying to understand why those cancer vaccines worked in some people but then didn't work in others really led you a lot to looking at tumor microenvironment. I think you've done some incredible work there in understanding mechanisms that modulate the initiation of that immune response. And so maybe talk a little bit about that work and how that is maybe a fundamental difference between, say, a flu response and a response against cancer.
And you're absolutely right. I think we're appreciating how as cancers grow and advance that they are clever. They will usurp a lot of different mechanisms to make sure that they evade the immune system from losing antigens, losing MHC molecules, to then creating a local microenvironment by bringing in other cell types that can get dysregulated and affect our ability to really make an effective immune response. So we've looked at myeloid cells in that respect. For example, one of the areas that we looked at is bladder cancer. But working with Matt Galsky at Mount Sinai, we found that myeloid cells can get recruited into the bladder microenvironment and they are immunosuppressive. Sure. They can start making mediators that will block T cell function, like IL-6 and IL-10. The tumor can make TGF-beta that can also affect T cell function. And altogether, we're beginning to understand how different classes of myeloid cells can actually adversely affect what you're trying to do in terms of stimulating the immune system. And so we've come up with signatures of various myeloid cells that we now know are not good to have. So that's part of what we're working on as well.
That's fantastic. I think one of the other areas I think that's fundamentally different between your great work in infectious disease and the really pioneering work that you've done in cancer immunotherapy is the choice of the antigen. So having a completely non-self antigen is helpful for initiating response absent central tolerance. And now as we move forward, I think you've done such incredible work in the neoantigen space and trying to discover, really look at those mistakes that tumors have made and to capitalize on them as non-self antigens. Where do you see that field going? And as you look back on some of the early trials that you've done, moving forward, how do you see that field developing?
It's very exciting times, this whole concept of antigens being expressed by the tumor. And also the fact that there are probably many different kinds of new antigen classes. It's been very exciting to see that, first of all, developing algorithms that can predict immunogenic new antigens from patients. The first thing that we did when I came to Mount Sinai is try to develop our processes, procedures, pipelines to do that. And I think we're able to do that quite successfully. We validated that in a mouse model, but looking initially at SNPs as our first platform of antigens in cancer. Mm-hmm. And then using that to really prove in patients with bladder cancer, GBM, many other kinds of cancer, lung, breast, multiple myeloma, et cetera, that these new antigens can be immunogenic in vivo. And we are able to pick substantially large numbers of these that we have proven to be immunogenic in patients. So we're very excited about that, with early data suggesting longevity on the part of the patients. And that said, we've been moving also to trying to identify other new antigens, which include frameshift mutations, fusions. So we're developing pipelines for frameshift calling, fusion calling, taking into account adjacent normal tissue next to a cancer to understand how field effect can change new antigen expression. And then we're also looking at elements from the dark genome, repeat elements. Can these also be incorporated into our new antigen repertoire and novel open reading frames? So I think, honestly, like we're just, and we have this whole incredible group of neoantigens to pick from in the future. And then the other exciting thing is that we're learning that many of these antigens can be shared across patients beyond just the obvious ones like KRAS or things like that. Beginning to understand that there can be shared fusions, shared SNPs. So I think eventually we'll be able to come up literally with off-the-shelf antigens that we can incorporate into an individual patient's arsenal against cancer. And I'll just point out that we're also still interested in non-neoantigens, but shared tumor antigens we can again incorporate into vaccine platforms.
So if you look at just from the immunomonitoring standpoint, if you look at, say, successful checkpoint blockade and then go back and monitor the responses, antigen specific versus tumor testis antigen specific responses, or is that still unclear and wholly patient dependent?
I think it's still a bit unclear. I think it's still early. People have identified them. We certainly see expansion of neoantigen specific T cells. We've been not looked as well at shared non-neoantigen space as much, i.e., looking at epitope spreading. And I wouldn't be surprised if we see them because we do know that both are expressed. We do know other groups have identified TCRs that recognize both antigens in the tumors. So senses that we will see both.
And then you going back to just the cellular vaccine work that you've done, presenting dendritic cells as adjuvants, as true vaccine adjuvants, was really cool. What do you think the adjuvants are going to be for the next generation of neoantigen vaccines?
Most people give monocyte-derived disease. There have been some examples of people isolating plasmacytoid disease, which is another dendritic cell subset from blood, and using that them as a vaccine adjuvant, which has also proven to be immunogenic. But we've yet to really well evaluate and compare all the different adjuvant platforms. And that, in large part, has been because we can't get many of these cells in large numbers from blood, including the CDC ones, which are the main dendritic cell that do the cross presentation in vivo. And so we have, for the first time, developed a method that allows one to generate literally billions of those cells in culture. And we've now working with a company to standardize this, scale it up so that we'll have these cells to really test in vivo for the first time. Hopefully not too long in the future. And then we'll really be able to do some key experiments about which dendritic cell subset is really critically important in vivo as vaccine adjuvants. That said, we've worked with peptides and proteins, looked at ways to attach these antigens to dendritic cell-targeted antibodies, but we have now technology that will allow us to target Cas9a, for example, I hope, which is more targeted to CDC ones. And so we're looking at ways to actually send antigens to the right dendritic cell. I think if we can modify that RNA structure a little bit more, and as I said, we can target the LNP to the DC.
When you're hitting the clinic and you're treating patients, a lot of this is combination therapies that are out there. So how do vaccines fit into that combination strategy? How do you see it now, and how do you see it long term as they begin to move forward?
So we've tended to go into the setting of either no evidence of disease or minimal residual disease or and not metastatic disease so much. We have obviously used our vaccine in that setting as well and shown it to be immunogenic. I favor going in earlier because the disease burden is lower. The tumor is less likely to have deployed all these immunosuppressive approaches to inhibit a response. And so we've gone into the adjuvant setting post-resection in many cases. And we've also gone into the adjuvant setting with checkpoint inhibitors. But I do see, I think, where these vaccines could be beneficial, perhaps in the metastatic setting, very where the tumor burden is still not huge, but much lower, where checkpoint therapy is standard of care. Can we add on vaccines in that setting to improve the response to checkpoint therapy? and possibly even in combination with other interventions like chemo and so
Sure.
forth. So I'm still thinking about those settings where, and of course they will differ from cancer to cancer, I imagine, and maybe even in the neoadjuvant setting, and we start priming prior to resection, where we might have an impact on the tumor microenvironment through what we do prior to resection in order to eliminate not only disease locally, but also to eliminate micromets that we might not pick up even with resection.
It always strikes me that the vaccine-based approach, unlike many very aggressive immunotherapies, like even solid tumor CAR T therapies that are developing, which we were very supportive of, or even some of the side effects associated with aggressive checkpoint combinations, is that there's a large good safety profile here with these vaccines that have been out there and such an established history that it seems like if we can really show consistent responses, that they should reasonably form a backbone of any of these kind of immunotherapies. Building that army of anti-tumor T cells seems like it would never be a bad idea when you're thinking about other experimental
Right.
therapies.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And some of the things we're also thinking about is cancer prevention. So can we go in much earlier? And we have a program here at Mount Sinai on Lynch syndrome. Could we start vaccinating people who have to come in because they're at such high risk of developing cancer? So that's one area. The other is identifying through a program we have here, again, called BioMe, where people come in and have their germline sequenced, identifying patients, again, who are high risk of developing cancer. We know, for example, that there are germline P53 mutations and other things, that BRCA mutations, obviously. So can we think about identifying those patient subsets and thinking about prevention vaccines in those settings? So we're very excited about that as a field. We can do a lot in ensuring that the patients who are at high risk can get some of these vaccines earlier on.
Yeah, it's such an essential change in the way we think about cancer treatment, that particularly for these high-risk patients, that many of which have family members that have gone through cancer care and they themselves are rightfully concerned. If there was something we could do, it would be like a preventative vaccine to at least help assist that. It would be amazing, absolutely amazing. Even if it's just teeing up later immunotherapy to work better, having built that.
Exactly. And I think, especially in the setting of those patients who might have these driver mutations potentially. So those are the things that we're thinking about right now.
This is amazing. And I think that this is it's just a wonderful story from the progression of fundamental understanding all the way now to trying to identify those mutations, take them forward, and then move them into a preventative setting where hopefully a lot of cancer immunotherapy will go eventually. One question too, just getting back to your lab and your career, it seems like, as you said very clearly, that mentorship has always been an essential part of what built up your career. And you've been in a wonderful place with some great minds and continue to be. But how do you see mentorship in your everyday role? You've got so many young investigators that have come out of your lab that are just fantastic.
I think one is that you have to be lucky enough to get great people.
I hear that. Yeah.
And I think I've been very fortunate in my career to have had so many fantastic students and postdocs. And I think in my lab, I try to impart the philosophy that I had when I was being mentored, which is give them a lot of freedom, guide them as best you can, and treat them as equals. So we have a very good give and take with my group. I think they're very comfortable coming to me and I with them. I'm speaking on their behalf, obviously, but to give them a sense that they can experiment and work on projects, as long as we start out with something that is fairly defined in a direction that is reasonably clear, but with understanding that we may veer away from that path and go off into different directions. And so that, for the most part, has worked really well. And as I said, I'm really fortunate to have had individuals who are very self-motivated, hardworking, and just generally great human beings. So.
Yeah, there it is. I think I can attest to the fact that I know many people have gone through your lab. They've absolutely loved it. And
I hope so.
An incredible mentor to them in their careers. And I was speaking to Matthew Brown recently, one of the Pisces recognized scholars who said the same thing as part of member of your lab right now, that we think is just a real rising star within the community and someone we certainly want to support. He's great.
Yeah, he's super.
That's wonderful. That's great. Yeah. So Nina, I just thank you so much. I really appreciate this and appreciate the time and just looking back at the important work that's being done. I think the work that you've done to really pioneer vaccines is just hitting at absolutely the right time with the advances we've seen in vaccine, technological vaccine development with the COVID pandemic. Have really begun to focus now on an area that you're really hitting on. And having someone with such an incredible physician scientist like yourself pioneering this is, it's amazing to have you associated with the Parker Institute. And we're just incredibly thankful for all the amazing work you're doing and continue to do. So I thanks very much. Appreciate it.
Thank appreciate you. Your time. If I may say one more thing, it's been really an honor and privilege to be part of the Parker team. It was very exciting to be part of it when it was first established. And those meetings are my favorite. And the community is extraordinary and has done so much in furthering this field. So I feel very privileged also. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Dina.
Thanks for listening to From Bench to Fireside. And special thanks to this season's PICE Network contributors from Dana-Farber, UCSF, Stanford Medicine, Mount Sinai, UCLA, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and Weill Cornell Medicine. To donate to support PICE's mission, please visit parkerici.org/donate. You can find From Bench to Fireside on Spotify. To be notified of new episodes, like or subscribe to our channel. For the latest at the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy, follow us on X and LinkedIn at ParkerICI, or visit www.parkerici.org to learn how we aim to accelerate the development of breakthrough immune therapies to turn all cancers into curable diseases. From Bench to Fireside is produced by the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. All content and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the Parker Institute. From Bench to Fireside is a trademark of the Parker Institute for Cancer Immunotherapy. We'll see you next time as Parker Network experts in immunotherapy take you from behind the lab bench to the frontiers of cancer research.